I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FU Network TV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
It's time once again for the Broken Clock Podcast, and this episode, we are talking about the logic of immigration. Of course, we are inspired by the Supreme Court saving kind of the DACA executive order that allows the young adults known as Dreamers, people who came to the U.S. as children without papers, to sound very, very authoritarian and fascistic. There you go. Nice German, Mouse. But I guess you have to pull off decent German if you use a handle like Mouse, right?
Yes.
So people came to the country through no fault of their own. They did not make the choice. They know no country but America. And yet some people want to kick them out anyway. This offends the sensibilities of the majority of people, including the majority of Republicans. And yet it's this political football that nobody seems to want to pass or play, or they're just using up all their timeouts. Apologies to those who listen to this who don't follow sports ball. But let's get into the logic of immigration. Now, the simple argument for immigration is the one that Ali Velshi on MSNBC uses all the time. Ali Velshi is, he jokes, a Kenyan-born Muslim who grew up in Canada and then immigrated to the U.S. And he makes the argument both the U.S. and Canada have relatively low birth rates. In order for the economy to grow, in order for all the jobs that keep being created to be filled, we need a steady stream of immigrants. So things like healthcare or Medicare in the US and retirement pensions and just a general tax base can be maintained without raising taxes on everybody. Now, that's a very logical, very practical argument that seems to fail to persuade. So even though it makes complete sense, you get into the they're taking away our gerbs argument. And as much as people joke about, you know, that they're taking away our jobs argument, and somebody can argue that it wasn't your job to be taken away, there's still this sense of these belong to us worldview that is very, very, very hard to uninstall, for lack of a better term, because now we're dealing with worldview. Right? Mm-hmm. So let's get into the idea of worldview. Let's get into the idea of ethics, because Mouse, you have, as an immigrant yourself, you have written rather extensively and rather deeply on this, and we'll provide a link to it for people who want to read more in a very dense way. But, you know, in the article you wrote called A Proper Immigration Policy, you get into the idea that it is actually immoral to restrict immigration on the grounds of anything but security, correct?
Correct. So my starting thesis is that immigration in and of itself is a right, in that it pertains originates from the values that are necessary for a person to be able to thrive and sustain their lives. Now, when I say immigration is right, I do not mean citizenship is a right.
Right. Very different thing.
Yeah, I have to make that distinction because I, for example, I believe that, in fact, my position might be even a little bit controversial for some people because I don't believe you should become a citizen by birth. I believe that the citizenship process should be taken consciously, so that when you're born, even if you're born to an American citizen, you are basically born maybe a resident, but mm-hmm. then you should have the ability to take that extra step, that extra commitment, you know, after you've reached the age of 18 or whatever, and of course, my conception of citizenship is very different from what currently exists. You know, in my conception of citizenship, you would, being a citizen would entitle you to vote, would entitle you to be able to run for government, for office, etc. It's not nearly as, you know, you cannot enter the country as more of as staking a commitment to, you know, the country, its principles, its systems, and to be, in many ways, a watchdog to keep that country in track.
I've actually heard this theory before, that voting should be like driving. That, you know, you should be tested and you should show a certain amount of skill before you're given the given these privileges, as opposed to rights.
Right. You know, that immigrants who become citizens have to go through a civics and history test. Mm-hmm. In many ways, I think that should extend to just about everybody.
It's interesting, because that was originally floated when they were constructing America, for lack of a better term. But like everything in America, people who didn't want to give rights to anybody but an elite white ruling class pointed out that literacy meant that the bulk of the country would not be able to vote.
Right.
So it's this thing of, and this is the trouble we get into with a lot of the big debates nowadays, especially in the US, is that things that logically check out, ethically check out, because I think people are like, yes, the idea of voting as a responsibility instead of voting as a right makes a lot of sense. It creates a better quality in candidate, a more informed electorate. But then we get into the disenfranchisement and white supremacy that has run through the history of the U.S., the fact that the U.S. was built in part on the backs of chattel slavery, that complicate this issue significantly. Because if you think back to when these laws were being created and when, you know, people got the right to vote at varying levels of degrees, we didn't have the high level of literacy we have now. Mm-hmm. And even things now like, well, you can't be on parole, are being used to suppress the vote in many places. I'm not convinced that that's a good rule anyway. But yeah, I mean, I think we recognize that the current system of immigration in the US, but also in Canada to an extent, is kind of broken.
Yes. And the breaking of the immigration system in the United States has a long and storied tradition. Many people, even those who fight in favor of the Dreamers, don't fully understand the process of what it takes to become a legal immigrant. In fact, if you take a look at the process now versus what it was in 1980, in 1970, the process has become more draconian and more, it's not even Baroque at this point, it's Rococo.
It's a form of indentured servitude when you just have work permits in the US, at least for entertainers. That's my lens into this, that I know people who, you know, they did the whole thing. They joined the unions in Canada because it's easier to get into the US as an entertainer if you're part of a Canadian actors union, because ACTRA and SAG are sort of sister unions. So
yeah,
you go to kind of the front of the line. But even then, your right to work in the country is not contingent on your skills. Mm-hmm. It is contingent on an American employer wanting to employ you. And the minute you lose your current gig, you have to scramble to find something, anything, or you lose your status.
And that is pretty much similar to what many people are going through right now with H-1B visas, mm-hmm. where their work was affected by COVID. And when you lose your employment and you're on an H-1B visa, you have only a certain amount of months to find employment before you have to pack your bags and go.
Yeah, which in this situation is ridiculous, because that actually puts companies, when they do start up again, in a more difficult situation. They've lost their workforce.
Not only that, but you know, if they want to rehire the person, going through an H-1B visa application is an absolute nightmare. The process, like I said, most people are not really aware of what it takes to go through, what people say the proper channels, get in the line. Just as a very, very overhead example of what an H-1B entails, your employer, they have to fork out several thousand dollars for the process and for the petition and for the hiring of lawyers. Yeah. Not only that, but they also have to prove that in this field of work, and here we came to the date ticker derps entitlement, that there is no other American available who applied for the job that would have met the requirements for this position. And then once all of that is filed, there is a certain date by which the company needs to submit the H-1B visa petition. Mm-hmm. However, what usually happens is that on that day, immigration gets absolutely flooded with petitions because there's way more petitions than there is a quota. And yes, and there is a cap on how many petitions are allowed per year, how many visas. It's first come, first serve. It's not first come, first serve. It's kind of like a lottery.
Yeah, it's a lottery here too.
Yeah, so your company has invested thousands of dollars and then they drop that submission in, and candidates get randomly selected. And if your company didn't get selected that year, it means you don't get that H-1B visa, but it also means that company doesn't get the money back. The government just pockets those thousands of dollars.
Now, telework, thanks to COVID, may break the back of the system just through creative destruction because, okay, you can't bring that person into the country now, but you can have them work from their country, and all that requires is a W-8 form.
Yeah.
And that means they're spending the money that you're paying in the U.S. in their home country, meaning all that trickle-down stuff that conservatives claim to love happens in their country, not America. Like that's when you start seeing the problem. Like it's almost like you look for examples and you see some of the problems with the logic of the US system, because you're actually encouraging wealth to flow out of the country through the current system.
Wealth is a manifestation. Wealth is the embodiment and the result of the enterprising human spirit. So it is going to go where it's going to go. if you block and dam it, it's going to go, it is going to find a different causeway. Like, in many ways, it's like the effects of prohibition. And this is where we get into illegal immigration, because, prohibition was a violation of the rights of the individual. Like, who the hell are you to tell me I am not allowed to drink booze? It is my right to drink booze, and it's my right to destroy my life drinking it if I do so choose to do so, if I make that choice. Because of that infringement, we had the black market of booze. We had the moonshiners, we had the smugglers, and of course, we had the rise of the mafia in the United States.
Yeah.
So, because again, when people are deprived of a right, oh, give me one second, I need to cough.
Yeah. Oh,
there.
There we go.
Done. When people are deprived of a right that is genuinely theirs, they're going to try and get it no matter what. No matter by what means. So at that point, you're essentially just creating criminals.
Yes. Yes.
Criminals.
And this offends people's idea of morality, the idea that you can create a criminal impulse.
Well, yeah. And here's the thing. You're essentially creating criminals who perpetrate victimless crimes. But in order for these people to have access to the things that they want, you essentially have created a criminal subclass that furnishes these things to them. And in many cases, who will do so going above and beyond
Well, you're not only causing them to commit a victimless crime and then call them a criminal, you're also forcing them into a cycle of poverty, which also is a driver of crime.
Mm-hmm. And then you create genuine criminals, such as, for example, the rise of the mafia, who saw the opportunity that was created by prohibition, who saw that people want to have access to booze, and there really shouldn't be a reason why they shouldn't. So they thought, you know, we can bolster our power by providing this service that the government has now declared illegal. Likewise, the drug cartels with the war on drugs.
Okay, let's face it, though, those are seen incredibly differently today, though, because people don't see Italians and Jews as, you know, not white people nowadays. Back in the immigrant wave where the mafia got going, they very much were.
Mm-hmm.
But the margin has sort of shifted. That's something people don't realize about the structures of organized crime. I mean, the drug trade, that the war on drugs is designed to allegedly stop, it isn't fueled by addicts who are poor black and brown people. It's fueled by white money.
Yeah.
You know, the end customer for the drug trade is usually rich white people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so where was I? And like that as well, you have the coyoteros, the people who smuggle people across the border, often in incredibly life-threatening situations, and people who use immigration, the excuse that they will provide you with a pathway to the United States as a way to pretty much enslave people and also trick some people into sex trafficking.
Yeah, I mean, that's one problem with there being no right way to do it. There not being a robust temporary foreign worker program in the U.S. If there's no right way to do something, then people are going to do it the wrong way.
Exactly. And here's the thing. Nowadays, for example, there are very, very few ways to become a legal resident. One of them, and that's, of course, by design from conservatives, is through family. You have to get married to a U.S. citizen, and they have to petition you, which incidentally for gay and queer individuals, this was not possible. It is possible now. But it was not possible thanks to the Defense of Marriage Act, which defined marriage on the federal level as only between a man and a woman. So, of course, if Steve married Earl, and you know Steve is from South Africa, Earl could not petition his partner because they were, you know.
Because there's no better way to defend an institution than to cut down on the number of people who can do it. But that's a piece of a logic for another time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the immigration through family, of course, if you are the child of a U.S. citizen and for some reason are not a citizen yourself, such as you were born in another country or your father became or mother became a U.S. citizen after the fact, they can petition you. Now, this petition can take up to 10 years.
Didn't Ted Cruz do that?
I don't remember. I tried to wipe most of Ted Cruz.
I know his mother's Canadian.
I might be.
Certainly Melania Trump took advantage of the marriage route.
Yes. Then there's evidence that she may have actually violated in terms of her work visa. Mm-hmm.
Neither here nor there.
Neither here nor there because
Do we care if Melania Trump violated the terms of her work visa? I don't really.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
Okay.
However, I do like holding Republicans accountable for what their alleged principles are.
Yeah. That's fair.
They're so quick to point out all of the people who are in violation of status in one way or another. And let me tell you this, it is incredibly easy to enter a violation. The system is so over-detailed and there are so many rules. It is very easy for a person to commit an error.
Let's face it, before Donald decided to run for president, most of the Trump family were Democrats.
Yeah.
So their professed morality at the time was not inconsistent with violating a law they decided to be unjust. I'm sure many of them have used marijuana or other controlled substances as well. Like, let's be real here.
Yeah, Jared does kind of have that kind of face. But
oh, I was thinking of Don Jr., but there you go. But I
have no idea what he's on.
Yeah. Or what's keeping his hair back. But again, that's neither here nor there. I mean, here's sort of the issue I have with immigration and why I find the way it's being done illogical, right? Mm-hmm. Part of the thing that drives U.S. academic institutions, the Ivy League, the private college system, meaning the ones that would have not changed at all had free public college gone through, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, so on and so forth. A great number of their students are visa students. Mm-hmm. The post-secondary, the elite post-secondary system thrives here too in Canada on visa students, on foreign students. So under the current U.S. system, the U.S. is essentially educating its competition, including apparently Kim Jong-il.
Yeah. Here's the thing. And I know, and I say this as someone who had a student visa, an F1 visa, mm-hmm. And through several degrees. It's the experience of an F1 visa student is very interesting because you have working restrictions. You're not allowed to work on campus unless you can show financial hardship, at which point you can be given a 9-month permit to work outside of campus, which then you can renew. Problem is, of course, if you file too many of these, then they will start looking at your application and going, are you really sure you should be studying here? Because you really can't afford it. And of course, then there's the danger of your visa reapplication
right.
to be denied, which they can deny for any reason whatsoever at the consulates.
That happened with Saudi medical students here because of a diplomatic rep. The Saudis actually revoked their ability to study in Canada.
It was, let me tell you, every time I went home to renew my visa, it was nerve-wracking.
Wait, you actually had to travel back to renew your visa?
You can't renew it in the U.S. You have to go back to the country of where the visa was issued. You can't renew it in the U.S.
So the whole system is just to drain other countries of wealth through their rich kids?
Pretty much, because then you'd have to travel to your home, your point of origin. And then you go through the application process, and then you are leered and glared at by the consulate official who stares at your passport and your visa and asks you questions in the most absolutely rude manner. In fact, I remember at one point, this is when I was still fresh off the British boat, so to speak, when I was studying at the British Council. So I had a very, very strong British accent at that point. And I remember this consulate office man just glared at me and said, do you even speak English? In English? Oh. And I said, yes, perfectly.
Yeah.
And at that point, I brought up my Cambridge certificate mm-hmm. of English. And he still had me to go through the CPT, which I think it's called the CPT, which is the English proficiency exam.
They actually make you write a test. They can't just talk to you and see if you can speak the language.
You have to go through a whole test, even though I produced my Cambridge certificate of English proficiency issued through the British Council by the University of Cambridge, by the Cambridge University. They still had to go and test me to see if I spoke English.
See, my late stepfather would claim that people who don't know how to speak bloody English were testing you who did because you learned properly. That's just because we're recording this on Father's Day and I had to do a shout out. But seriously, he had a real issue with anyone in North America questioning anyone's English because as far as he was concerned, none of us could bloody speak it.
and then of course, it was harrowing because I thought, you know, at that time I had a boyfriend and I pretty much had a life brought up in the United States. I had absolutely no desire to live in my country of origin. I didn't identify with it at all. Mm-hmm. My life was made here. Right. I had friends, I had a potential career, I had, you know, all sorts of things. And the thought that this overpaid bureaucrat could essentially deny my visa application, he didn't have to justify why. It's absolutely terrifying that your life is in the hands of a bureaucrat who has an axe to grind.
And this is where I think we really drill down to the moral illogic of U.S. immigration policy. It's the fact that normally a legal code, except for drugs and apparently immigration, is if something is not explicitly illegal, then it is legal. That is true of most laws, right? Unless it specifically says you can't do this, then you can do it, right?
Right.
Why the exception for immigration? Now, the argument is, well, they're not citizens, therefore they have fewer rights. But that's not how rights work. That's how privileges work. You can't turn off something that is a right. If something is a right, then it is a right to all humans, regardless of the, you know, artificial boundaries of the social constructs we call countries that they were born in. A right is a right and therefore applies to anyone. Mm-hmm. If it can be taken away, it is by definition not a right. It is a privilege, except in the circumstances of, you know, you killed someone, therefore you go to jail, therefore you lose the right to free movement.
Yeah.
But immigration policy as is currently inherently criminalizes free movement.
Yeah, pretty much. Not only free movement, but free commerce as well. Because part of the F1 experience is, like I said, is that you're not allowed to work outside of campus unless you have this, you know, justification, which could put your visa in jeopardy if someone decides that maybe you can't really afford to live here. Although, you know, you have to remember, F1 students are not allowed to work outside of campus.
Right.
Most jobs in campus pay peanuts.
Really?
Yes. And here's the thing. On campus, most of the good jobs are already taken. And those students who have the good jobs will do whatever they can to hold on to them for good reason. Because, you know, otherwise you end up in cafeteria duty.
Yeah.
As I did. The difference is I went to a college that was a work college.
Okay.
My undergrad was at a work college, so everyone on campus had a job.
Okay.
Every student was supposed, you know, they were supposed to learn the value of honest labor.
That's called work study up here. Yeah.
Really? Interesting. Yeah. So, and of course, from that you got some money taken off of your tuition. Which made the college more affordable. Right. So you had students staffing the cafeteria, the composting team, the heavy duty team, the electricity, the plumbing, the library, the computer lab. So not only were you getting your academic training, but you were also learning skills such as plumbing, which is incredibly profitable. You could leave the college and eventually apply for a license as an electrician because of all of the, you know, all of the credit, etc.
You had the work hours required to apply
for hours, yeah, mm-hmm, and the knowledge,
the journeyman certification, yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But of course, even in that college, very few people wanted to be in the cafeteria crew, because the cleaning and stuff is not fun.
Oh, it's a miserable job. Yeah,
it is a pretty miserable job. Even though our supervisor made it fun, Reese, her name was, she was hilarious. But you know, even then, you had people vying for other positions, and they would watch the job boards like a hawk because, you know, some people who were technologically oriented, they wanted a job at the computer lab, and those would fill up almost immediately. Hmm. And you had continuing students, etc. But, you know, the situation wasn't as bad in that college because everybody had, you know, everybody had to work. Mm-hmm. And the college was structured to support that. So even the international students such as myself, you know, had, you know, a little bit of income, and that went into, you know, your meal plan for the year, etc. Mm-hmm. Other colleges that are not work study colleges, you know, don't work like that. So you don't really have money taken off your tuition from mm-hmm. for working on campus. You just get paid like the minimum wage. If it's the cafeteria job, you know, the nice jobs like the library and the computer lab and the more specialized jobs are always full. And the international students that get those jobs, of course, will hold on for dear life because they don't want to be, you know, nobody wants to be cleaning dishes.
Right.
But you know, the difference is this, you know, if an American citizen student is having a hard time financially, they can go and take a second, you know, they can take a camp, you know, they can reduce their hours by half, for example. You know, they can take a partial semester and they can take on two jobs.
Yeah, they can become a part-time student, work full-time.
And they go, and you know, they can work. International students can't do that. You have to have a full credit roster, and you can't work outside of campus. And if you are putting in a work permit request, it has to be a job that aligns with your profession.
Right. Because it's a money thing. They want the revenue for a full-time student.
So, and well, that's on the, and that's also, you know, you cannot work outside of campus unless you file the application with the government, they grant it to you, and it has to be a job that is somewhat related to your field. So of course, imagine if you did that to American students. Well, you know, you can work. I see that you are an archaeology student and you are having some, you know, hardship. You need to work. If you need to work outside of campus, it has to be an archaeology related field.
Right. See, this isn't a system that effectively trains the workforce of tomorrow. This is a system that is for profit, straight up, like money now, very short term gains.
It's self cannibalizing.
Yeah, it's self. Oh, there's got to be a thing where you can combine cannibal and capitalist to create, or because you know the minute you start messing with capitalism, something like that. Because it the minute you start messing with capitalism, it quickly becomes the opposite of capitalism. That's the thing people don't understand about capitalism, but. Right. You know, people would say, well, this is the problem with capitalism, except it's not.
It's statism.
Yeah, it's statism, but it's also just, it's greed. Mm-hmm. It's, we want the money now. We're not developing, we're not saving for tomorrow. We're not creating a bank of talent, a bank of skilled labor that we can then withdraw from. When we need to. I mean, it flies in the face of practically all ancient knowledge. You know, the whole idea of, you know, in the Bible that Joseph had a dream and they prepared for the coming famine by food stores. Who'd have thought? You know, yeah. it's totally, and this is what a lot of bad economic policy does. It's, things are great. Let's spend like crazy. And it's like, yes, you should spend somewhat. You should spend reasonably when revenues are coming in. But you also need to save. You have to keep something in reserve so you don't take on as much debt. When mm-hmm. Now, of course, we just came out of an absolutely absurdist time of economic policy where a flawed model insisted there would be no such thing as bear markets ever again. That was just obscenely ridiculous. Like the story behind that is for another time. But that was that.
This is turning into the never ending story. But that's another story to be told at another time.
But I think that actually is at the core of the flaws in North American, but especially American immigration policy. Immigration policy, instead of being a cohesive policy on its own that actually makes sense and creates the best outcomes, is just a collection of symptoms of neuroses borrowed from other policy portfolios, if that makes any sense.
Yes. So the driving force behind the ridiculous scenario that I told you about, the F1 students, but also the H1B visas and all other work visas. As I say, it's a bit of a hit and miss.
The fact that the whole thing is alphabet soup just, you know, is an example of the problem with the whole system.
Yeah, and you're going against rigged odds because there's a tiny cap and there's way more applications. Mm-hmm. There's obviously businesses that really want to hire these people, but the government says, no, we only let you hire enough.
But let's face it, that facilitates cronyism as well. Just the example of the Trump hotels. They strangely got very lucky with the foreign worker visa system. That isn't luck, that's corruption.
Yeah, that's corruption. Yeah. And then you have the investor visas, which require you to have hard cash of about $500,000 and up.
We had one of those through the TV station I worked at. Mm-hmm. The argument was we bought American programming so our crews could go down to interview the Americans that produce the American programming because we're investors. Uh-huh. That didn't work well at all. We just got the hairy eyeball at the border all the time being told we had the wrong kind of visa. And, you know, me being me, silly me, I learned the hard way you don't do this. But I said, well, if it's the wrong visa, your consulate gave it to us.
Yeah.
Which is logical. But border crossings, especially at the time, because it was pre-9/11 and it was the Canadians are taking our entertainment gerbs. Yes, we were the great foreign threat regarding U.S. economic prosperity at a time. It seems like so long ago, but they, you know, part of the problem with immigration policy, it's enforced by people who maybe have a high school education. They can't be expected to correctly interpret an ever-changing, very Byzantine system that has all these letters and numbers and what do these things mean? We don't know, right? But I mean, at the core, the idea that a Canadian coming down with a Canadian camera crew to interview an American celebrity because we're promoting American product and that's somehow taking a job away from Americans is absurd to anybody that knows anything about economic policy.
Yeah, here's the core, one of the cores is that the American immigration policy is predicated upon a zero sum wealth concept.
Well, Keynesian wealth being finite resource. Yes.
Of course, if you tell this to a conservative, they will deny this because they're supposedly pro Hayek, even though they're not. They're definitely not.
I think conservatives tend to do a bit of a bamboozling of the U.S. They know how economics works, right? And when they're talking to their big corporate donors, they correctly state wealth is created. But when they're trying to convince a working class American to vote against, and I shouldn't just say American, they do it up here too. Mm-hmm. They're trying to convince a working class person to vote against their own self-interests. Suddenly, they start treating the running of government like household budgeting, which, yes, you do have a fixed salary. You can't just create wealth as an individual. That is correct. They know that that's the perspective the majority of people have. They have this salary. They have to live within their means. That is not how macroeconomics has ever worked. They know that. And so their pitch to the public is inherently duplicitous.
And the harping on the jobs, it's doubly duplicitous. Because they employ that wealth as zero sum assumption that the public often has. And it's one of the reasons why, for example, Marxism is still very popular to this day. Because in the United States and in many parts of the world, people do not understand how wealth is created. Mm-hmm. They only understand scarcity. That is that they don't have enough money. They never seem to have enough money. And of course, they don't look at the governing bodies and their economic policies and how those policies are affecting the worth of their money, how many barriers to entry there are to jobs that they artificially create. And so they just look and say, well, yeah, wealth is a zero sum game. We bring immigrants in, they're going to take part of my pie and I'll have less of that pie.
Right, right.
And so they harp upon the notion that there is such a thing as American jobs or Canadian jobs. It's, you know, if the immigrants harm Americans by taking away their jobs, what do people, you know, people who propose this, what are they going to do about the Americans who take away the jobs of other Americans? Because if every American citizen is entitled to a job, and that is the working assumption that we're starting from here, then it means that for every American citizen who is accepted into a company, all of the other applicants have been harmed by being denied the job to which they were entitled.
You know what? The tribalism going on in America basically adds evidence to your theory, right? Mm-hmm. They cut out, immigrants are taking our gerbs. And so what happened? We started getting racial tensions. We started getting class tensions. Now it's the liberals are taking our jobs. It's true. The minute you cut off one other, you just create a new other. You don't solve the problem.
Yeah. And it's you know, the principle that they want to push is the right to a job. Or that is the right that you must have a job. That is American. That is guaranteed to every individual. Well, if you're saying that that's a right, then it has to be enforced and protected by the government. So how would the government enforce this right to work, this right to an American job, if not by, say, using legislative force to make people hire other people, whether they want to or not?
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, conservatives will tell you that they're all in favor of property rights, right?
Property rights,
that's a big word. So here's the thing. Here's the question I would ask those conservatives. Well, is your company your property? Do you own your company?
Well, that's a catch-22 for conservatives, because they were the ones that pushed the idea that corporations are people.
Right. And here's the thing. So as a company that I own, which is my property, do I not have the right to hire a candidate that I want to hire because I think they might be more capable, or I think that they might actually get along better with my team? So let's say I have Steve here, who is from New Jersey, right?
Right.
And he's applying for the same job as Igmar from Norway.
Right.
And I look at both of their resumes, and they're pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
So then I go down to the interview, and I interview Steve, and I go, "Oh yeah, he's an okay guy. He's kind of self-righteously abrasive, though. I don't know if he'll be a good, right, you know, New Jersey. But I don't know if he'll work well in this team." And then I talk to Igmar, and he is a marshmallow. He is super sweet. He's, you know, very much open to suggestions, etc. He seems like a team player. I want to hire Igmar.
Mm-hmm.
So as my, since it's my company, don't I have that right? Don't I have that? If Igmar were, you know, Sammy from North Dakota,
right,
the government would say, oh yeah, you have that right. Totally, totally, you have that right.
Yeah.
But then it suddenly Igmar comes from Norway. Oh, no. You have to pay us and ask us for the privilege of hiring someone.
Well,
that we may or may not deny.
You're presenting layers of hypocrisy in the conservative perspective here. I'm not sure if you're realizing how many layers of hypocrisy and contradiction.
Oh yeah.
Okay, because I have thought about
this and written about this for a long time.
But okay, let's break this down. Let's break down what you just unpacked here, because like this might be enough for people, and then we'll have to stop and we'll have to do a part two, because this is a lot. Just like it just shows what a Gordian knot this is, right?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, are corporations people or are corporations property? Because if corporations are property, then corporate personhood is nonsense, and a lot of conservative-leaning Supreme Court decisions, et cetera, are wrong. If a corporation is a person, then claiming you own a corporation is slavery.
Yeah.
Contradiction number one, okay? Because you can't own a person. That is illegal. But now you're getting into this idea that the government, conservatives maintain the right for the government to discriminate based on nationality, mm-hmm. but they complain about government upholding unfair discrimination against any other essentially immutable characteristics. Now, one mm-hmm. could claim you can change your nationality, but it is not easy.
No,
right?
It is
your
not
current
easy.
Your current nationality is an immutable characteristic. You cannot change it right now. It is a lengthy process.
It is an accident of birth.
Right.
It is not a voluntary choice.
So they are treating nationality as a fundamentally different thing mm-hmm. than any other immutable characteristic that they complain they can't discriminate based on.
Exactly.
The Democratic position may not be a good one on this issue, but at least it is consistent. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, you just, in the Igmar parable, you just basically dismantled all conservative opposition to a more open immigration strategy on multiple levels without even getting into the inherent cruelty of it. You didn't need to do the appeal to emotion. You broke it apart simply based on logic. Well done. That was like a Jesus level parable, man. I'm really impressed. Of course, you know, I'm Jewish, so I just explain the whole parable when it's probably much more effective to have the parable. That's what we do. We have two books to explain the one book.
The one book.
The one book, which explains itself 60 times over and over and over. But I mean, let's face it, the Torah was actually one of the very early critical thinking documents.
Yeah.
People don't realize that that's what it is. Like, be fruitful and multiply. Okay, that's basically life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Because why do you have to say be fruitful and multiply if it means the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, life. Life is the most important thing. Well, what do we need for life? Well, here are these things. And that's the way the whole book unfolds in a series of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other strange thing about the whole so-called Christian underpinning of the US and Canada anyway, the alleged Christian underpinning to these horribly unchristian policies, like the whole idea of being generous to the stranger at the table, the idea of prodigal sons, the idea of strangers in strange lands.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of stories in both the Old and New Testament that say, be good to immigrants because you never know. You know, the earthly parents of the Messiah mm-hmm. were people who were denied accommodation and had to sleep in a barn. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what happened? Wise men showed up and gave them things of value.
Yeah, wise men from outside.
Yes, they traveled a very long way. We know these stories, but they don't embed. And that is so odd. Most people are not taught critical thinking. Most people don't want to think critically. It's a hard, time-consuming process that can sometimes wonder if you're smelling toast. But that was a joke. You don't actually smell toast when you think critically. But, you know, okay, most people don't want to think critically. Just be consistent with your own moral mythic structure. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to break this down. Other smart people have done this and put it in story form so you can consume it like a television show thousands of years before we had television shows, and they still manage to screw it up. And this is where we get into the power of worldview and the backfire effect, right? Yeah. Which is everywhere right now. Everywhere. And this is not something that just conservatives partake in.
No, it's not. This is not a partisan guilt, because here's the thing. The issues with immigration fall equally, up until this presidency, because this presidency has attacked immigration in an unrestrained manner. Mm-hmm. Up until the monster that was Stephen Miller got power, the path to what this current system is lays equally in blame on both the Democrat and the Republican side. The Republicans constantly, of course, drumming to the xenophobic base that for many, many decades they denied was not the core of their constituency, but this presidency has shown otherwise. And on the side of the Democrats and the liberal side, you do have a xenophobic base, but it manifests itself differently.
Yes.
It manifests itself through unions. A large number of the immigration restrictions that were backed by Democratic officials were put in place to protect unions from competition from immigrants, which is kind of funny because so many
blacks,
of the...
And Southern blacks yeah. migrating north.
Yeah, which is kind of funny because so many of those unions were started by immigrants.
Yes.
Yes. But that is the great paradox of America, where it tries to present itself as the land of freedom and opportunity. But there is this strange psychosis that happens where after a couple of generations, people seem to forget their roots. People seem to forget where they came from. And they are very, very keen on trying to lock the doors that let them in.
I'll amend that theory a little bit. I don't think people forget their roots. I think people mythologize their roots.
Because let me put it this way. You cannot be a thinking human being with the last name of Coulter.
Or Cruz or Rubio
and launch into screeds about immigrants. And here's the thing. I forget now his name. It's kind of funny. I forget his name now because he was such a non-entity. But for a while, he was gaining momentum in Colorado. He was running for office. I wish I could remember his name. Because this is what I did to him. And he was running on a very staunch anti-immigration platform. And he came to my college, as these people often do. And he held a Q&A and all of that. Well, I decided I was going to be a little shit stirrer, as Stephen has called me.
Stephen is my husband, for people who don't know.
And I did some research. Because this man was favoring a very, very, very strict immigration policy, whereby you had to have a college degree, a certain level of financial, independence to be able to become an immigrant here. So I did my research. Because I noticed that he had an Italian last name. So I went into those genealogy websites and I went through public records, etc. And so by the time that he was doing his Q&A, I dutifully queued myself for a question. And when my time came up, I said, "Well, you have these proposed amendments to immigration. Is that correct?" And he said, yes. And of course, he went to this, "I believe that." So I went, "Okay, well, I want to ask you a question on this. Because here we have these immigration of public record records that state that I think it was his great-great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather and great-great-grandmother immigrated to this country from Sicily.
Right.
Now, according to this records, your great-great-grandfather was a farmer. He had very little money, and both your great-great-grandfather and your great-great-grandmother were illiterate. So basically, the proposals that you're putting forth would have kept your great-great-grandfather and great-great-grandmother out of this country. So therefore, your grandfather and your great-grandfather and your father and you shouldn't be here.
Yep.
You probably wouldn't be here because your great-grandfather or your great-grandmother and their family might have died in one of the world wars.
Right. Very likely.
Next question.
That's all. Just next question.
Next question.
He totally woofed it. See, that's a lot of people actually don't know. And I guess we'll land here because this is kind of topical in a different way. A lot of people don't know that the particular kind of xenophobia in the US when it comes to immigration actually has its roots in the practice of slavery. And a lot of people roll their eyes on this, but unfortunately, like it or not, guys, slavery is America's original sin.
Yeah.
The illogic of thinking you can own a person even when that person is a company. No, that's just kidding. I don't believe corporations as people is so illogical. But anyway, but the idea that you can own a person. Well, here's what the slave trade did. The slave trade created an economy run by people who chose to migrate, or their ancestors, far outnumbered by the people and descendants of people who were forced to migrate in that they were slaves. And so if you gave these forced migrants, i.e. slaves, equal rights to the slave owners, they outnumbered them. They would become a de facto power base just because there were a lot more citizens
of them
and voters and all this stuff. And that is where the doublethink in terms of good immigrant, bad immigrant, or, you know, oh, this what they call implicit bias.
Bias.
We've got to do an episode. There is nothing unconscious or implicit about bias.
Bias.
Bias is a cognitive construct. It cannot be unconscious.
And the next part, I want to address illegal immigration, because there's just so, it's a boogeyman on the right, but we don't have enough time to go into it now.
It again is demonizing people who come here through hardship, right?
Well, yeah.
It's back to slavery. It's black and brown people are less than us. They can be here as long as they know their place and don't try to usurp our artificial power.
Well, not only that, but you have the rules and the laws and the regulations to become an immigrant are so time consuming, so expensive, and so many hurdles that are near impossible to overcome that you basically make it so that in order for people to exercise their right of immigration, they have to break the law. Because the law is now creating criminals out of innocent people.
Yeah, there are a lot of contradictions. Yeah.
Because, like I said, if so many of these anti-immigration proponents had their ancestors who came to this country put to the same levels of rigor and gatekeeping that they're imposing now, those families wouldn't have made it into the country. Very few families would have made it into the country. So we have here the promise of America, because America struggles with the promise of what it could be and the promise that other people don't want it to be.
And that's where we'll pick up next time. So unless something else literally or figuratively explodes in the US, next week we will continue our examination of immigration with the artificial construct that is illegal immigration, or as we call it up here, irregular migration.
That sounds like an Activia commercial. Are you suffering from irregular immigration?
Symptoms may include, never mind. Okay. We'll deal with that next time. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network. Wherever you're listening right now, check out our website, funetwork.tv, to see what else we got on offer, our various other podcasts, as well as our store or one-time PayPal donations, as well as becoming a Patreon. We're going to have to start doing Patreon events or something like that eventually to get people to become patrons. We're not going to stop you from immigrating to our patron. But until next time, thinking is good for you, even if it hurts sometimes. Mouse, as usual, you have the last word.
Well, I'm going to end with that because we did not have a hit. Take a hit right now, because I'm going to do a quote by Ayn Rand about immigration. No one has the right to pursue his self-interest by law or by force, which is what you're suggesting with closing the borders to impede immigration.
The streak continues.
Woohoo!
This is fun! The FU Network!